Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. Welcome to our 29th episode of this September 25th, 2014 program. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Cooper.
And how are you doing tonight, Ray?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
Well, that's good. It's always wonderful to hear your voice and connect with you again. Last week we ended with a section
27th of February.
And I had not read that section before the show. I had not gone quite that far. And so I was a little bit lost when you were reading it. I thought, now what's this about? And we talked about it a little bit, but I did said, well, maybe we'll say more about it next week. And I did look at it, and there's a lot that's interesting there. And I had to study up a little bit to figure it out and catch up. But, you know, one part of it, this is towards the end part, was about France and what was, you know, how France was divided up at that time. And I've always was a little hazy about that. I never really paid attention. And so I figured that out. He's talking about what if we... see, they just have their occupation government up in the northern part and in Paris. And then the real France, but which is the collaborative France, that's where Pétain is down in the southern part. So, but he's saying, what if we set up a real French government in Paris? What would happen? And from that, he went on to some of the history and saying that we give too much credit, we pay too much honor to Henry the Lion, because he, this goes way back, he actually frustrated the policy of Friedrich Barbarossa and Heinrich the Sixth. I don't know too much about him, but, and that was more of an expansionist policy for Germany. And then he said that if this expansion had been pursued logically back then, we'd have this great Germanic empire stretching from Denmark to the Loire, and England would not have acquired the importance that is hers today. So that, you know, that makes sense in just what he was just talking about and speculating on, and just, it's just kind of chit chat. But as far as that goes, but I'm glad I got that straightened out, because I never like it when I think, particularly if I'm doing a program about something, that I don't really understand what has gone by. And then there's one thing more, unless you want to comment on that, what I just said.
No, go right ahead.
And then he says propaganda can play an important role in our favor. It's not just a matter of attacking each Englishman individually to induce him to such and such a particular action. I guess trying to change the minds of the English. It's a matter of a propaganda that sets forth undeniable facts and consequently slogans that fall upon a well-prepared soil that in their minds, he means, you know, for them to receive what we're encouraging them to think. And he says, for example, the British Empire is becoming more and more a colony of American Jews. And that's an example of the propaganda he thought would be good to somehow get across to the British in the right way. And I did comment on that last week because I just liked the line, but that is really, really good stuff. And then, as you said, he commented that at Westminster Abbey, they even played the Internationale, which was the Communist Internationale, after their service. And he ties that in with the fall of Christianity, which he had been talking about earlier, saying that all these signs showing that Christianity is losing its strength. So, anyway, and then he says, it's a turning point in history. And I asked myself, what's a turning point in history? He says, all this stuff is that. And I figure he means the transition from Christianity to whatever is coming next is, maybe he thinks National Socialism, but is happening. And that's a turning point in history. I think that's what he meant there. That's just my opinion.
Right.
Okay, well, I have some timelines, but I don't have one for right now, so I appreciate being able to say those things. You know, tonight's episodes are interesting, but there's nothing really earth-shaking. But it's a lot of interesting things.
That's right.
The way I see it. Yeah.
So we'll have fun.
We'll have fun with it. All right. Well, anytime you want to start, Ray.
Okay. We got it the night of the 27th, 28th of February, 1942. The financial organization of the party press. Amon's great idea was to guarantee the financial existence of the newspaper by the profits realized on the party editions. These profits accumulated so quickly that the newspaper quickly stopped being exposed to any risks. Amon realized that what a tour de force it was to maintain the house of publication during my incarceration in Landsberg. For once, the juggleries of the lawyers were useful to us. The publishing house was a limited company, and the law required the unanimous agreement of its members for its dissolution. By chance, one of the members, Herr von Sibatendorf, was always abroad in Turkey, I think, and of course, Amon could never succeed in getting a hold of him. At the time, I owned a part of the capital. Gutberlet had made me a present of a share of 5,000 marks, and I had bought other shares. The firm had existed for 30 or 40 years under the name of Franz Eger Publishing Company. I retained for the newspaper the name of Volkischer Beobachter. Dietrich Eckert was furious. What's the meaning of that word, Beobachter? And in parentheses it says observer. He would say, I could understand something like the chain smasher. Very intelligently, for reasons of camouflage, Amon created on the side the Hoheneichen Publishing Company, whose name covered certain publications, and he left the press to Adolf Mueller so as not to have to bring action against party comrades for payment of their bills. Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, just to me, Carolyn, he's saying what a sound footing that the National Socialist Press was on financially and the importance that it was kept going while he was incarcerated.
Yes, right. Right, and then, I loved it where he named it the Beobachter, which means observer, and Dietrich Eckert was furious about that, and he said, what kind of a name is that? You know, I would use something like chain smasher, or, you know, smashing the chains of the Weimar regime or something like that. But, you know, look at how well the Beobachter did, and there was no problem with the name of it.
Right.
Everybody liked it, and it was hugely successful, so I kind of like that better than if it had one of those chain smasher type names.
Well, I agree.
The Schirmer was enough for that.
Oh, yeah, and to me, the observer is more of an intellectual approach and reaches a wider audience than the chain smasher. Is more revolutionary sounding, and it may appeal to a more limited crowd. So I agree with you on that.
It was a mainstream newspaper, it became. I mean, it had all the news. Of course, it was put out by the party, but anyway, everybody read it. So, and then the last part is interesting because he's talked about this before, and when he says he left the press to Adolf Mueller so as not to have to bring action against party comrades for payment of their bills, they actually did that. Because Hitler had said that the party members, especially some of them who really sacrificed a lot and did a lot, they didn't think they should have to pay for party publications and pay for the papers and so on. And they often didn't. They didn't pay their bills, and they didn't want to have to go after them because actually they had. It's true. They were sacrificing a lot. So what they did was they turned it over, the press over, to this Mueller and let him own it. And then he collected the money because he wasn't the party, see. And so these party members still had to pay. So they weren't giving the party members any break in that because they needed the money. Thought they did. So that's the way they worked that out. Pretty clever, huh?
Yeah.
At least Hitler thought it worked out pretty well. Well, for the next one is February 28th, and on the 28th, the Japanese land forces invade Java. I'm not even sure where Java is. Gosh, where is Java? Ready?
It's off of the Mandalay Peninsula in the sea between Australia and I guess what we would term Southeast Asia in that area.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it's already on the way to down there close to Australia.
Yes.
All right.
It's a stepping stone on the way to Australia.
All right. It's too bad they're not doing so well in Russia as the Japanese are doing in the Southeast, but then they lost that advantage too eventually. So.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, the 28th of February, 1942, evening. Housing crisis, new constructions. To put an end to the housing crisis, we shall build, as soon as the war is over, 1 million dwellings a year, and that for 5 consecutive years. The time necessary to build a house should not exceed 3 months. In this field, the achievements of modern technology must be used in their entirety. The mistress of the house must be set free from all the minor chores that make her waste her time. Not only must the children's play gardens be near the houses, but the mother must not even be compelled to take her children there herself. All she should have to do is to press a button for the woman in charge to appear immediately. No more refuse to take downstairs and no more fuel to carry up. In the morning, the works of the alarm clock must even switch on the mechanism that boils the water. All these little inventions that lighten the burden of life must be set to work. I have a man, Robert Lay, to whom it will be enough for me to entrust this mission. A nod from me, and he'll set everything humming. Every dwelling should carry the right to a garage, and there's no question of this garage costing 40 or 50 marks a month. It ought to cost a tenth of that. If we haven't reached that point today, it's once again those damn lawyers we have to thank. I've been told that these maniacs of the civil service have found nothing better to do than to compose a file in which all possible accidents, imaginable or unimaginable, have been foreseen. And they've used this as a foundation on which to base their regulations. Thus, they make such demands that building costs become impossibly high. In many cases, they're based on technical peculiarities that became obsolete 20 years ago. For example, there's a regulation limiting the angle of the stairs to a certain number of degrees. This regulation, if it's applied, entails enormous expenses. Time wasted, room wasted, materials wasted. What's more, it's necessary to standardize the necessary components for the construction of interiors. Don't ask where to begin. If we succeed in sparing the 5 million families who will inhabit the new apartments the useless expense usually involved in a move to a new dwelling, this will already be progress. Everything must have a beginning. Let's begin at once. And that's very forward-looking. It's exactly what hit the USA after the war with these cookie cutter houses, as they may have called them, in those standardized neighborhoods and Levitt towns, and that sprung up, and it was a miracle how quickly they were built, and they were nice little homes, and it was standardization that enabled that, the cost to drop, the time to build them to be cut, and he's saying this stuff in 1942.
Right, they probably got those ideas from him, although they may have been in the air, but. A lot of people may have been having them, but that Hitler was going to do that too. Certainly would have needed to do a lot of building. Oh, well.
Yeah.
This Robert might be Robert Lie. It might be pronounced Lie in Germany, like Heydrich and all those others.
Uh-huh.
But I've always heard it Robert Lay.
That was my initial impetus to call it that.
Yeah. Yeah. But it could be an Americanized version of it. I'm not sure. Somebody might be thinking, somebody might know for sure. But in any way, I've always heard everybody say Lay. He was a terrific man. I mean, let me say, he was a very competent, capable, and energetic. He was like 110% totally believed in Hitler, totally believed in National Socialism. And so Hitler says, "Here, I have a man. He'll do. I'll just tell him, and he'll set everything humming." That's exactly right, you know. But it wasn't that he, you know, he didn't respect him. He did because he could always depend on him. You know, this just shows to me how Hitler just loves planning for the betterment of the people. I can just see how much he was, how happy he was talking about this, you know, what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and how well it's going to work. And there was nothing that he liked better than thinking about building in Germany to make Germany better and make the life better for the people and so
on.
That this really was where his heart was.
That's true. All of his goals, whether internally within the nation or even externally, like Lebensraum and expansion of living space and taking in more farmland, every bit of that was about his people and doing for his people to improve his nation.
And he thought they deserved it because Germany had a hard time over and over again, you know, wars, all kinds of wars.
That's
he
right.
thought that he'd like to think that there would be a better day coming for the German people and they would get what they deserved and have the influence they should have.
The night of 28th of February and the 1st of March, 1942, the Bayreuth Festival, 1925, Bayreuth and National Socialism, the role of Cosima Wagner, Siegfried Wagner. In 1925, the Becksteins had invited me to stay with them in Bayreuth. They lived in a villa in the Litzstrasse, I think this was the name of the street, within a few yards of Wanfried. I had hesitated to go there, for I was afraid of thus increasing the difficulties of Siegfried Wagner, who was somewhat in the hands of the Jews. Now, you know, let me stop right there, Carolyn. I want to bounce this off of you. I read that last week, and then I reread it again today, and he's made that reference before about Wagner being somewhat in the hands of the Jews. And if we see something like that today, we automatically think, well, this guy is a servant of or gladly doing the bidding of the tribe. But in these instances, when he said that, I think what he's saying is that he was very much susceptible to them and had to be careful because they held his economic strings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's not that he was a servant of the Jews and bowed to what they needed, but he was limited in a lot of what he could do because of the hammer they held over him financially.
Well, right, because he was running the Bayreuth Festival, and he was in charge of all that. You know, he is Richard Wagner's son, Siegfried, and so the Jews were very powerful in all that, and he... You see, what that family had to deal with was not being so radical that they destroyed their beloved festival and all the grounds there and everything that Wagner had left behind, and they could perform all his work every year, and people came from everywhere, and it was a world-famous event and so on. So they didn't want to destroy that, and the Jews were always there watching for every little step. Yeah, and I'm glad you stopped there because I wanted to point out that here's another parenthesis, and this one is Hitler himself speaking.
Yes.
It has to be.
Yes.
So we know that. He says they lived in this on this street. I think this was the name of the street, within a few yards. So these parentheses are just, I brought it, I don't know if we've had one where we knew for sure it was Hitler before, but this definitely is. So you never know whose comment is inside those parentheses. It's, once again, pretty confusing. That's all. I was going to point that out.
Okay. I arrived in Bayreuth towards 11 o'clock in the evening. Lottie Beckstein was still up, but her relatives were in bed. Next morning, Cosima Wagner came and brought me some flowers. What a bustle there was in Bayreuth for the festival. There exist a few photographs of that period in which I figure, taken by Lottie Beckstein.
Okay, I think I should interrupt for Cosima's name, because I got that from Frederick Tobin.
Tobin?
I asked him a few weeks ago how you pronounce that, and he told me definitely Cosima. So I didn't want you to keep saying it wrong. So.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. If Frederick says it, it's got to be right.
That's right. You can always ask him yourself. He's very good about giving the good, proper pronunciations of
sure. I used to spend the day in leather shorts. In the evening, I would put on a dinner jacket or tails to go to the opera. We made excursions by car into the Fichtelgebirge and into Franconian Mountains. From all points of view, those were marvelous days. When I went to the cabaret of the Chouette, I found myself immediately in sympathy with the artists. I was not yet celebrated enough for my fame to interfere with my peacefulness. Dietrich Eckert, who had been a critic in Bayreuth, had always told me of the extraordinary atmosphere prevailing there. He told me that one morning they had broken into the Chouette and had gone, in company with the artists, into the meadow behind the theater to play the Miracle of Good Friday there. At the first performance of Parsifal that I attended at Bayreuth, Cleaving was still singing. What a stature, and what a magnificent voice. I'd already been present at performances of Parsifal in Munich. That same year, I was also present at The Ring and at the Meistersinger. The fact that the Jew, Schorr, was allowed to sing the role of Wotan had the effect of profanation on me. Why couldn't they have got Rodi from Munich? But there was Braun, an artist of exceptional quality. For years, I was unable to attend the festival, and I'd been very distressed about it. Cosima Wagner also lamented my absence. She often urged me to come by letter or by telephone, but I never passed through Bayreuth without paying her a visit. It's Cosima Wagner's merit to have created the link between Bayreuth and National Socialism. Siegfried was a personal friend of mine, but he was a political neutral. He couldn't have been anything else, or the Jews would have ruined him. Now the spell is broken. Siegfried has regained his independence. One again hears works by him. Those dirty Yids had succeeded in demolishing him. I heard in my youth his Barenhalter. It's said that the Schmied von Marienburg is his best work. I still have a lot of things to see and hear. In Berlin, I've been present at a performance of a work of Richard Wagner's youth, The Novice of Palermo, containing themes that are still reminiscent of Mozart. Only here and there, a few new themes make their appearance, the first fruits of a new style.
Well, that was interesting. And I'm going to give some information about Siegfried, just to put everything out there, because Hitler said that he was a personal friend of Siegfried, but Siegfried was politically neutral. And I'm not sure just what he's referring to when he keeps referring to the fact that the Jews had demolished him, but then he says he's regained his independence. He's talking about 1925. He says in 1925, Siegfried was somewhat in the hands of the Jews. Well, Siegfried died, I think, in 1930, and that's when his wife took over. Well, here's the story of Siegfried and his wife. Siegfried's wife was the great friend of Hitler, Winifred, you know, all that time,
yes,
as he mentions here. And also, I want to say, and I don't mention it often enough, that our theme music for this program is Siegfried's Idol, I-D-Y-L-L, which was written to honor his birth, written by Richard Wagner. And presented to his wife, Cosima, or she wasn't his wife yet, presented to Cosima on the day he was born, that their son was born, and they named him Siegfried. And I read that he was born before Richard and Cosima were married, but probably not too much before. So they were having a love affair. I guess they were greatly in love and devoted to one another and so on. I think Richard was married before that. But anyway, as a 23-year-old, he undertook a trip to Asia with an English composer friend named Clement Harris. And it is said that it was on that trip that this Clement Harris aroused Siegfried's homoerotic impulse, because Siegfried was considered bisexual, not actually homosexual, but bisexual. He couldn't give up the men. And his mother, there were different scandals, you know, not always involving him, but different scandals going on. And his mother urged him to marry so that he could have an heir and could carry on the family business and so on. And but he resisted until 1913. There were some big scandals involving some other people, and that supposedly forced him to agree to choose a wife. And the family found a 17-year-old English woman named Winifred Klindworth, so I never knew any of this, who was introduced to him at the Bayreuth Festival of 1914. And they had four children. They had, and he was, I think he was about, no, he died in 1930. How old was he in 1913? I forget now, but, oh, did it say, didn't it say here?
23, was it?
No, 23 went on that trip. In 1913, the family introduced him to this Winifred, and anyway, he was quite a bit older than her. He really was. He was quite a lot older than her. But they found this woman seemed to be the right one. And she was a devoted wife. And they had four children. And they were 4 years in a row. Like, as soon as they got married, they produced these four children. And then that was it. And it says that Siegfried couldn't be cured of his obsession. So, but he died in 1930, shortly after his mother, Cosima, died. And so he had been named the head of the, you know, the festival after she died, but then he died. So then Winifred took over, and she continued running it for all many, many years. And she was a devoted, she loved Germany and German culture and Germans. I mean, she never acted like she was Miss England or, you know, wanted to be English. She was devoted to it. And, of course, she is the one who loved Adolf Hitler. And Fred Tobin has even suggested that there was some kind of love between them, but maybe not sex or anything. But they did have a very great fondness for one another, and Hitler appreciated her and appreciated the welcome that he had at Bayreuth every time he went there and so on. So it's too bad about Siegfried. I'm sure Richard Wagner would not have liked that. Good thing he didn't have to see it.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
You know, one interesting note there, just a personal note, that name Winifred, that was my mother's middle name.
Aww.
And, you know, I haven't heard that name much at all in reading or anything like that, so it kind of jumped at me. But that was Mama's name, Blanche Winifred.
Yeah, and, well, that's a very English name, isn't it?
Uh-huh, that's right. And,
that's the way I
think. So, anyway... Okay, we'll go on to the 1st of March, 1942,
okay,
midday.
Timeline. I'm sorry.
Go right ahead.
Too late. On the 1st of March, a Red Army offensive in the Crimea begins. In the north, the siege of Leningrad continues. So now the communists have turned, the Bolsheviks have turned and created an offensive in the Crimea, and the Wehrmacht has been all in control of that area for a while, but they weren't able to eventually hold on to it. This is when this started.
1st of March, 1942, midday, special guest Himmler. A picturesque personality, the party printer. It was through Dietrich Eckert that I got to know Mueller. Our first encounter was not favorable, and I was astonished that Eckert should have put me in touch with such an individual. I agree that he's as black as the devil, Eckert replied, and more cunning than the cunningest peasant, but he's the best printer I've known in my life, and also the most generous man. That happened well before I had the Volkischer Beobachter. Mueller was wedged in his armchair with the self-insurance of a plutocrat. His first words were, "To prevent any misunderstanding from arising, let it be clearly understood that where there's no payment, there's no printing either." When one visited him, Mueller never ceased to groan. Nevertheless, he grew fatter and fatter. He printed more and more. He constantly bought new machines. what his leitmotif was. I can't get along on these rates. I'm ruining myself. To see you so fat, one wouldn't believe it. I've so many worries that I drink a little to drown them, and that swells you up. His press is equipped in the most modern style. He's a real genius in the party. Cunning. Nobody could be more so, but he was an employer with a sense of social responsibility. He paid his workers well, and when he took them on an outing, he paid no attention to expense. For a firm of that size, in any case, that meant less than nothing. And the Volkischer Bellbachter was always there to cough up. I never made a journey with Mueller without his having to pay a visit to some woman by whom he had a child. At the birth of each of his bastards, he would open an account for them at the savings bank with a first payment of 5,000 marks. I actually know four illegitimate children of his. I wonder how such an ugly blighter manages to have such lovely children. I must add that Mueller adores children. Every week he spends 2 days with Ida on the Tegernsee, although he's divorced from her. He had married her simply so that his children should have a respectable name. He likewise spends 2 days a week with his legitimate wife at Munich, and lastly, 2 days at his business. The rest of the time he devotes to shooting. That Mueller's really quite a fellow. Oh, yeah, with some picturesque personality, all right.
Yeah, he was just obviously a very hard-working guy, and he's continued to be their printer for all the way through, I do believe. He was always complaining about not getting paid enough money, Hitler says, but he didn't quit, so that was just his way. But it's interesting that
Well, I was just going to say back and forth there where he says, I can't get along on these rates, and I'm ruining myself, and Hitler says to him, to see you so fat, one wouldn't believe it. He says, well, I got so many worries that I have to drink a little bit, and that swells you up. That was pretty good.
Right. And then he spends 2 days a week with the woman he's divorced from, and he married her so that his children with her would have a respectable name. I guess he'd had the children, and then he spends 2 days with his legitimate wife. That's all. She's probably happy about that. That's plenty. And so on. Anyway.
And then, days at his business. So that's 6 days. So I said then the rest of the time he devotes to shooting. So.
Yeah, I guess shooting was a hobby or an enjoyable thing for many, many of these men. They liked
it. That's right.
At least he's talked about that before. Okay, you go ahead and get started, Ray.
Okay. 1st of March, 1942, evening. Special guest, Himmler. Jealousy of women. Disproportion between men and women. Polygamy and the 30 Years' War. Hypocrites of the upper classes. The bourgeois marriage. Social prejudices on their way out. In the eyes of a woman, the finest of dresses at once loses its charm if she sees another woman wearing one like it. I've seen a woman suddenly leave the opera at the sight of a rival who had entered a box wearing the same dress as herself. What cheek, she said, I'm going. And the pleasure a woman takes in rigging herself out, there's always an admixture of some troublemaking element, something treacherous, to awaken another woman's jealousy by displaying something that the latter doesn't possess. Women have the talent, which is unknown to us males, for giving a kiss to a woman friend at the same time piercing her heart with a well-sharpened stiletto. To wish to change women in this respect would be ingenuous. Women are what they are. Let's come to terms with their little weaknesses. And if women really only need satisfactions of that sort to keep them happy, let them not deprive themselves by any means. For my part, I prefer to see them thus occupied than devoting themselves to metaphysics. There's no worse disaster than to see them grappling with ideas. In that respect, the point of disaster is reached by women painters who attach no importance to beauty when it's a question of themselves. Other women are extremely careful of their appearance, but not beyond the moment when they found a husband. They're obsessed by their outlines. They weigh themselves on exact scales. The least gram counts. Then you marry them, and they put on weight by the kilo.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you, Ray.
Okay.
You know, I resent this a little bit. I
sure.
think that Hitler is having a good time here, picking on women in order to make
yeah.
some jokes and so on.
That's
he
exactly
just like,
right.
He likes
He's
to get
entertaining
on that.
His guests.
Right. Except that some of these people there, it's always those secretaries are there. See, this is was this lunch time? This is in the evening. You know,
yes.
those secretaries are usually there, and I think that that's why he changed his, started talking about men after this. But anyway, just to say a little more about this, you know, it's not unknown for men to have that same quality that he's saying only women have, and give a kiss to a friend or
oh, yeah.
to give a, you know,
yeah, that's right.
greeting and whatever, and same time have only bad thoughts,
oh, yeah.
You know, in their mind about them. And he's even talked about that, Hitler has, when he's talking about those the court in Italy and so on, those courtiers and so on,
yes.
how snake-like they were. So, but, you know, it's obvious that he just likes to pick on women. And he probably even did it around Eva Braun, and she'd just sit there and give him dirty looks or something, or might have done more than that. But anyway, I don't take it too seriously, so that's
right.
men like to do that. So that's what I have to say about that. So let's see what he has to say about men. He's a little bit softer on men. I think that at this point, a secretary made a comment here to prompt him to say this. Because remember, in a previous time, he was talking about marriage and how he didn't think much of it or something.
Yeah.
And these secretaries, some people gave him a look, and it turned out to be the secretaries. And he then said, oh, well, but, you know, then he started saying, you know, correcting himself a little bit. So I wouldn't be surprised if they were giving him looks right here.
Oh, yeah.
If they were there.
Without doubt, when we mock at women's artifices, they should pay us back by pointing out our own coquetry. Our poor male coquetry. It's true that we shave, that we get our hair cut, that we too try to correct the mistakes of nature. When I was a child, only actors and priests had shaven faces. At Leonding, the only civilian whose face was beardless was regarded as the most extreme of eccentrics. The beard gives character to some faces, but it's easier to describe the true personality of a shaven man. By the way, the evolution that has taken place in the sense of sobriety seems to accord with the laws of nature. Hasn't man gradually, through the ages, cleared away some of his hair? In the countries where women are more numerous than men, the female has recourse to all kinds of methods to dispossess her rivals. It's a form of the spirit of conservation, a law of the species. The gentlest woman is transformed into a wild beast when another woman tries to take away her man. The bigger the element of femininity in a woman, the further is this instinct developed. Must one regard this innate savagery as a fault? Is it not rather a virtue? The state of society in which woman was regarded merely as a slave, as is still the case in certain tribes, would be, if we return to it, a clear regression for humanity. But it's not the only possible state. In prehistoric times, matriarchy was certainly a fairly widely spread form of social organization. When all said, a people never dies out for lack of men. Let's remember that after the 30 Years' War, polygamy was tolerated, so that it was thanks to the illegitimate child that the nation recovered its strength. Such particular situations cannot give rise to illegal regulation. But as long as we have in Germany 2.5 million women vowed to celibacy, we shall be forbidden to despise the child born out of wedlock. Social prejudices are in the process of disappearing. More and more, nature is reclaiming her rights. We're moving in the proper direction. I have much more respect for the woman who has an illegitimate child than for an old maid. I've often been told of unmarried women who had children and brought these children up in a truly touching manner. It often happens amongst women servants, notably. The women who have no children finally go off their heads. It's somewhat striking to observe that in the majority of peoples, the number of women exceeds that of men. What harm is there, then, in every woman's fulfilling her destiny? I love to see this display of health around me. The opposite thing would make me misanthropic, and I'd become really so if all I had to look at were the spectacle of the 10,000 so-called elite. Luckily for me, I've always retained contacts with the people. Amongst the people, moral health is obligatory. It goes so far that in the country, one never reproaches a priest for having a liaison with his servant. People even regard it as a kind of guarantee. The women and girls of the village need not protect themselves. In any case, women of the people are full of understanding. They admit that a young priest can't sweat his sperm out through his brain. The hypocrites are to be found amongst the 10,000-strong elite. That's where one meets the Puritan, who can reproach his neighbor for his adventures, forgetting that he has himself married a divorcee. Everybody should draw from his own experience the reasons to show himself indulgent towards others. Marriage, as it is practiced in bourgeois society, is generally a thing against nature, but a meeting between two beings who complete one another, who are made for one another, borders already, in my conception, upon a miracle. I often think of those women who people the convents. Because they haven't met the man with whom they would have wished to share their lives. With the exception of those who were promised to God by their parents, most of them, in fact, are women cheated by life. Human beings are made to suffer passively. Rare are the beings capable of coming to grips with existence. Okay, that's the end of that one right there. But there's some provocative stuff here. But, you know, it goes back to what you said a while ago, Carolyn, about Cosima. You say that their first baby was born before she got married to Wagner.
Right.
And you see, and Hitler is so non-judgmental about that. In fact, he says, I have a lot more respect for the woman who has an illegitimate child than the old maid who has none. Mm-hmm. And he's very accepting of this, and he draws it out as to why this happens. And you can't really legislate against it or anything like that, you know, because the women outnumber the men. You have something like the 30 Years' War. And in some nations, you know, the population of women is so much higher. And so that's why illegitimacy to him was not something to raise such moral hell about.
No, he was all for... what he's saying here, all for new life. You know, new life is good.
Yes.
And
yes.
Which is new German people, you know, increase the population. Not every woman could find a man and could get married, and then they're supposed to spend their life, you know, childless, and which was what they call an old maid,
yes.
Because you had to be married and so on. All these social customs, which, of course, when they're totally gone, like we have, in our countries today, then, you know, we wish we had a lot of that would come back. See, but
yeah.
One extreme or another, to go to an extreme is not good. And then I think it's interesting. He's mentioned before about all these women who have married the church, and he says 2.5 million. Did he say? Now, how many, what number did he give here?
Yeah.
2.5 million
right.
Women vow to celibacy in Germany. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, out of 70 million or so, okay. So he thinks that's a big mistake. I think it's a big mistake, too, for all these, the church
sure.
to take up such a huge amount, a number of people, men and women, and say they can't have, you know, they can't have families. So
right.
Plus, I liked where he said that it's like a miracle. If two people who are really meant for one another happen to come
That's
together,
right.
Because most people, they marry somebody, but they're not the perfect person for them. And sure. They make the best of it. You know, I mean, you have some attraction in the beginning, but I think that too. If you find that perfect one who you, boy, that is a miracle, because it's kind of rare, pretty rare.
Yeah, that's true. Third of March, 1942.
Okay, and on the third, Japanese aircraft make a surprising raid on the airfield and harbor at Broome, Western Australia.
Mm-hmm.
A raid. It was just a raid.
That's right.
Yeah.
That was more of a propaganda thing. It was a military attack and a success and everything. It was to let the Aussies know, hey, we're breathing down your necks here, and so it's time for you to start worrying about things because we're getting close. It was a threat, and it worked very well too.
Mm-hmm.
It really shook up the Brits and the Aussies, because you know, in the British, I was reading something this week, and I think it was pertaining to World War One, but. It was talking about the biggest surrenders, British loss of face or loss of massive amounts of troops. One of them was Singapore, and that was a tremendous defeat for the British. So, that happened in February, you know, and we're here in March now, so that has just happened. And the Japanese, as you pointed out a while ago, are really sweeping down through Southeast Asia, the Java Sea, and Australia is quite worried now.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I'll just give this right here now, because you mentioned that the Australians and the British were pretty darn nervous and upset by all this, and it so happens that on the 5th, we're talking about the 3rd, but on the 5th, there, in the timeline says, new conscription laws in the United Kingdom include women and men up to the age of 45. So they were responding by saying, man, we got to get everybody mm-hmm. signed up here and put our whole population to work who's capable of doing something. So that's pretty strong move, I thought. But that comes up 2 days later.
Yeah, and this takes me back to my, I think, early high school years. I was 15 or 16, and in our history class, we were covering the part of history about the attack on Pearl Harbor and the U.S. response and things like this. And I still remember asking my teacher at the time, I raised my hand, and he called on me, and I said, I know a little bit about this. We had some of it in junior high. But I have always wondered, why did the United States throw the tremendous bulk of his forces at Germany right after this happened, rather than against the people who attacked us? Because our troops in the Pacific theater suffered tremendously from lack of supplies, food, ammunition, medicine, because everything that we had was immediately, sent to Europe and to help the Soviet and whatever. And that always kind of perplexed me, because I said, hey, it's the Japanese that bombed us and killed people and whatever, and we threw everything we had at Germany. And that was just one of the questions that became one of so many for me as I try to start figuring this stuff out and making sense of it. And when we've talked about this,
probably wasn't answered very well.
That's right. Well, I still remember what the teacher said. He said, well, I think it was because the American leadership felt like Germany was the most serious or most dangerous of the two opponents, and they figured they better try to work on them first. Well, hey, you know. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's just politics.
Yeah, that's all.
Well,
so, anyway, I just wanted to mention that because, it made me think of it. But
see, now I wish I had you in my history classes in school, because I found history kind of boring.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know why, because I don't now, but at the time it just wasn't presented in a way, and it was like what you were studying it on your own. But I mean, it was presented. It was so cut and dried, or something.
Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah.
There's something going to come up here in a few pages that are going to address that very thing that I think I made a note.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. Okay. 3rd of March, 1942, midday, the road to independence, the British Tories are right, no German schoolmasters for the Eastern Territories, ideas on a curriculum for schools. If ever we allowed a country conquered by us to have its own army, that would be the end of our rights over that country, for autonomy is the way to independence. It's not possible to retain by democratic methods what one has conquered by force. In that respect, I share the point of view of the English Tories. To subjugate an independent country with the idea of later giving it back its freedom, that's not logical. The blood that has been shed confers a right of ownership. If the English give India back her liberty, within 20 years, India will have lost her liberty again. There are Englishmen who reproach themselves with having governed the country badly. Why? Because the Indians show no enthusiasm for their rule. I claim that the English have governed India very well, but their error is to expect enthusiasm from the people they administer. If it's true that the English have exploited India, it's also true that India has drawn a profit from English domination. Without the English, India would certainly not have a population of 380 million inhabitants. Above all, nobody must let loose the German schoolmaster on the Eastern Territories. That would be a sure way to lose at once the pupils he'd been given and the parents of these pupils. The ideal solution would be to teach this people an elementary kind of mimicry. One asks less of them than one does of the deaf and dumb. No special books for them. The radio will be enough to give them the essential information. Of music, they can have as much as they want. They can practice listening to the tap running. I'm against entrusting them with any work that calls for the least mental effort.
Well, maybe just we should just stop a second here. You know, this is the kind of thing that upsets people. If they hear us, they think, what a horrible person he was. Who did he think he was anyway? Because he is expressing that first he thought the English governed India correctly, which is pretty harsh and strict. And then he's saying that we should do the same in the East when we have control there. And really, we don't want to expect anything of people because we don't want to really make them smarter or have big ideas
That's
or anything.
Right.
Let them just live the way they do. So this is very, some people see this as really detrimental in any kind of admiration of Adolf Hitler.
Well, certainly it seems very cold and hard. But all you got to do is go back to the very sentence that opened this section where he says autonomy is the way to independence. And you give this conquered territory or these people autonomy when you start teaching them to do this, teach and let them have their own army and things mm-hmm. like this. So to keep this nation that you conquered under your control, you have to have that attitude.
Well, right, and even in your own nation, I mean, and we could, you know, there could be a debate about nations.
Well, yeah.
But it just brings to mind in Ukraine today that, you know, the Ukrainian government is whether you like it or not, anyway, it's the government of Ukraine. They want to keep it all together. And the rebels in the East want to have not just a certain amount of self-rule, but they want to have run everything total. They want to have a really pretty much complete autonomy where they would actually not even be a part of Ukraine, seems to me. And they've been talking about that lately, where they want to, you know, have their own elections. They want to decide on everything on their own. And so that's a situation where you have that, where if these people want this complete autonomy, that means they're going to be independent and they're no longer going to be under the, you know, under the federal, you know, government the way everybody else is. So it's a big question.
Yeah.
On how to proceed. It depends on which side you're on, really, isn't it? You know,
that's
I mean,
true.
That's what. Okay, so now he's going to talk about Russians in particular.
Yeah, just tell me how Russia has requited Europe for the European culture she has imported. They used it to invent anarchism. The more they're allowed to loll in peace, the happier these people are. Any other attitude will have the result of awakening ferocious enemies against us. And once again, to me, that's the logic, and that's why he said these harsh things. The
right.
logic of our pedagogues would entail the building of a university at Kiev. That will be their first discovery. In any case, I don't believe there's any sense in teaching men anything in a general way beyond what they need to know. One overloads them without interesting either them or anybody else. It's better to awaken men's instinct for beauty. That was what the Greeks considered the essential thing. Today, people persist in cramming children with a host of unrelated ideas. I'm going to stop right there for a second because of one thing that was just said. When he says it's better to awaken men's instinct for beauty, that was what the Greeks considered the essential thing. I think what he's meaning there is the arts. And if you awaken people that may be limited as far as being able to understand mathematics or anything like that, but there's always the possibility for the arts, whether it be drawing, painting, singing, music, and to me,
drama.
That's what he's talking about. Yeah, yeah, exactly, putting on plays. And he said the Greeks considered that was what they considered the essential thing.
And I think the beauty in ideas. I mean, just
creating
everything
sense.
Beautiful and harmonious and so on, rather than a bunch of what he thinks facts that people aren't going to use. If they're not going to use them in their work or their life, he thinks there's not much point.
Yeah, it's
in
a waste
trying
of time
to
and
cram
effort.
It down into them. Yeah, and harms them.
Right. School training should form a foundation on which it would subsequently be possible to build, if there's room for it, a specialized instruction. In any case, instruction must be adapted to things as they are. What counts today more than the trivial details is the history of the Reich. It's a waste of children's time and a useless cumbering of their minds to delay while one teaches them item by item all that concerns the village, the region, and the country. Let's not forget that the events which we are in the process of witnessing will one day be recited by heart in all the schools of the Reich. The brain of a little peasant boy can't take in everything. Moreover, there's the sense in teaching a child in an elementary school a foreign language in addition to German. Where is that sense? 80% of the children will never go further. Of what use will the rudiments of a foreign language be to them? Let's rather give them some general knowledge. Thus, instead of teaching them French for 4 years at the rate of 3 hours a week, why not wait until the last year? And even during this last year, let's give them only 1 hour's French a week. That's quite enough to give a good start to those who intend to continue their studies.
So I guess he doesn't want to learn French.
I saw it as his point being that there's, 80% of the children in school are never going to need to know French. They're not going to be involved in that or nowhere near, having to speak the language or anything. And for the ones that are, let them go on and soak up what they can.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, you're right. I don't think they'd be taught very proficiently at 1 hour a week for 1 year. But,
I agree with you. I agree with you.
Yeah. Okay. Do you see the necessity for teaching geometry, physics, and chemistry to a young man who means to devote himself to music? Unless he has a special gift for these branches of study, what will he have left over of them later? I find it absolutely ridiculous, this mania for making young people swallow so many fragmentary notions that they can't assimilate. In my day, pupils were not only compelled to achieve a given average, but also in certain branches, their reports must not fall below a minimum level. If a pupil is particularly brilliant in his specialty, why embarrass him in his studies by obliging him to assimilate notions that are beyond his powers of assimilation? Wouldn't it be better to help him further in the direction that comes naturally to him? 40 years ago, the teaching of history was restricted to a dry listing of dates. There was a total absence of principles. What happened when the teacher into the bargain lacked the necessary gift for giving these dead things a soul? Such teaching was a real torture. And that's what I was talking about a while ago, that we're going to come up on this. And,
yeah.
And history was my major, my field of study, my love, and it's what I taught. And he is exactly right. Just like everybody has experienced that's been a student from elementary school all the way through, you have good teachers, you have teachers that are not very good at conveying the message. And we all know that sometimes I've had history teachers that were very, very up on all their information and whatever, but were poor at conveying it. And their mind was there, but their ability to teach was lacking. And so I had all of that in mind when I was studying. I wanted to be a teacher from junior high on. I always wanted to teach.
Hmm.
And I got a lot of discouragement from that from my mother. She, teachers don't make any money, boy. Get out there and be a lawyer, be a doctor. But I wanted to teach, Mama. So anyway, so I kept all that in mind when I was going through and working on reaching my degrees so I could teach on the college level, was to make my subject viable, make it enjoyable. And I'm pleased to say that I think I did that pretty well at the college where I taught. And it was as a result of my experience with having mediocre to average to very good teachers and learning from them. So
right.
Yeah,
right.
But, you know,
when I was in high school, there was a lot of old teachers and junior high too, ready to retire but not quite, you know, hanging on there till, and my God, they were done in, you know, they were so boring. They're even eccentric and weird, some of them. Well, we used to have a lot of fun laughing about some of our teachers, but I just feel like I really got cheated. I thought, well, that's enough of that. Let's go on.
Yeah, I understand where you're going there with that.
Anyway,
he says, I had a teacher of French whose whole preoccupation was to catch us out in a mistake. He was a hair splitter and a bully. When I think of the men who were my teachers, I realize that most of them were slightly mad. The men who could be regarded as good teachers were exceptional. It's tragic to think that such people have the power to bar a young man's way.
Yeah, see, I had some of these slightly mad teachers.
Yeah.
Really, I would say so. They were getting weird in the head. Funny.
Mm-hmm. Some children have so much vitality that they can't sit still and won't and can't concentrate their attention. It seems to me useless to try to force them. I understand, of course, that such an attitude annoys the teachers, but is it just to deprive a child of the possibilities that life offers him simply because he's unruly? I remember that on the average, I spent a tenth of the time my comrades spent in doing my prep. My selected branch was history. I felt sorry for those of my comrades who never had a minute for play. Some children begin their school careers as excellent book learners. They pass the barrage of examinations brilliantly. In their own eyes, everything is at their feet. So what a surprise it is for them when they see a comrade succeeding who is cleverer than they are, but whom they used to regard as a dunce. So, yeah, just more about school and education.
Yeah, right. Okay, timeline for the fifth. Oh, I already gave, I gave the second one. Also, the Japanese captured Batavia, the capital of the Dutch East Indies. And then, of course, the United Kingdom got passed some new conscription laws, as I said before. And, and then I'm going to give the sixth, too, because we're coming up on the seventh, actually. So on the sixth, Malta receives more fighters for its ongoing defense. I don't know what was going on at Malta there. We've questioned that before, but who were they fighting for? Or who was fighting them?
At Malta?
Yeah.
That's That's in the Mediterranean, right? And it was German forces fighting British.
Okay, British were there. Okay, it was a British island. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, the 7th of March, 1942, midday. Peculiarities of the German language, abuse of consonants, borrowed words, license accorded only to great writers. If one compares the German language with English and then with Italian, a few remarks at once occur to the mind. The English language lacks the ability to express thoughts that surpass the order of concrete things. It's because the German language has this ability that Germany is the country of thinkers. The Italian language is the language of a nation of musicians. I was convinced of this one day at Ober-Salzburg, where I heard a speech by an Italian blinded in the war. When his speech was translated, nothing was left, a vacuum. We Germans are not inclined to talk for the sake of talking. We don't become intoxicated with sounds. When we open our mouth, it's to say something, but our language is poor in vowel sounds, and we must combat this tendency.
I would say he's talking about Latin languages, Italian, Spanish, which have a lot of very nice sounds to them, and people get carried away in speaking because of just the beautiful sound of the words and so on. I think that's what he's talking about. And
yes.
They do have, but you have to have a lot of vowels in order to have that kind of sonorous language, which he says the German language is poor in vowels. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and he brings that out. Today, Germany lacks poets, and our literature tries to make up for this deficiency by stylistic researches. We must take care not to attach too much importance to words. The form is only a means. The essential thing always is the inspiration. If we let our language reformers have their way, German would end by losing all its music. We're already restricted, unfortunately, to vowels A, E, and I. Moreover, we have far too many sibilants. When I say Kurzschiffler instead of stenograph, I have the feeling that I'm talking Polish. As it happens, the word itself is silly. Why not stick to the baptismal name given by the author? The linguists who recommend these Germanizations are deadly enemies of the German language. If we followed them in that path, we'd soon be unable to express our thoughts with precision, and our language would be poorer and poorer in vowels. It would end, I scarcely dare to say it, by being like Japanese, such a cackling and cawing. How would it be imaginable that one could actually sing in a language like that? Let's be glad we have a vocabulary rich enough to introduce infinite gradations into our thought, and let's gratefully accept the foreign words that have entered our language, if only for their sonorousness. What would happen if we expelled from the German language all the words of foreign origin that it has assimilated? First of all, we wouldn't know exactly where to stop. Secondly, we'd be stupidly sacrificing the extra enrichments we owe to our predecessors. Logic would bid us, whilst we're giving up a word, also to give up the thing this word signifies. It wouldn't be honest to retain the thing whilst repudiating the word. We'd suppress, for example, the word theater, and we'd try to pretend that it was we who invented the theater, now rebaptized by us. Enough of such childishness. Only writers of genius can have the right to modify the language. In the past generation, I can think of practically nobody but Schopenhauer who could have dared to do such a thing. As long as the language evolves, as long as it's alive, it remains a proper medium for expressing new thoughts and notions. I could wish that when we take a word from a foreign language, the German spelling would correspond to the pronunciation, so that everybody can pronounce the word in the same way. The example of the English in this respect is not a good one to follow. As long as a language has a letter for every different sound, it's not proper that the exact pronunciation of a word should depend on a knowledge of the language in which the word originates. A word should be written as it is pronounced. And boy, there's a whole lot of people throughout the years have said that same thing. And what he's getting at there, people don't realize it, English-speaking people don't realize it, that their language is one of the most difficult in the world for foreigners to learn because of the idiosyncrasies of the language. And what he says about as long as the language has a letter for every different sound, you know, it's not proper that the exact pronunciation of a word should depend on knowledge of the language. And take a word like laugh, L-A-U-G-H, cough, C-O-U-G-H. Now, that G-H carries the sound of an F. Well, a foreigner, you know, ask a child that's learned his alphabet, how do you spell laugh? He'll say L-A-F-F, or cough is C-O-F-F. Even liquid, I remember asking one of my granddaughters one time when she was like 5 years old, 6 years old, to write a few words down for me, and I asked her to write the word liquid, and she wrote L-I-K-W-I-D. Because a child picks up, she knew her alphabet, she knew the sounds the letters are supposed to make. And English is such a complex language with, if you use the Q, you have to put a U behind it, things like this. And that's what he's talking about when he says it's not really right that you should have to know the knowledge of the language in which the word originates and all. You just, as long as there's a letter for each of the sounds, then phonetically, that would really simplify a lot of things. And so that the particular paragraph, it really struck home with me.
Yeah, well, I wonder how far he would go with that, because you know, it's once you know a language, it's kind of hard that you want to change laugh to L-A-F-F or something.
That's right.
L-A-U-G-H, which looks right. Yeah. But you know, I always had a very good visual memory, and so I didn't ever have any trouble with spelling. I just would remember how words were spelled. I didn't use the phonetics. I wasn't taught phonetics. Probably good, because I was the type of person who didn't need it, and I just could remember every word I learned. And I actually checked to see if a word is spelled right when I'm uncertain, if it looks right. I mean, sometimes a word won't look right. I used to be better at this than I am now. It won't look right. And I'll know that it's wrong, you know, because how it's supposed to look. But he makes a lot of sense here. And he is saying, though, yeah, right, but mainly that the English language is not good when it comes to things being pronounced the way they're spelled, that's for sure. I guess German is, so that's a good thing.
Yeah,
once you learn all the ways that things are pronounced, then it's easy.
Yeah, you know, and I agree with you too, Carolyn. I never had a problem with spelling, you know, throughout school and things like this, because it, like you, when I looked at words, they seemed to stick with me, and the spelling and all was okay. This makes sense, and things like this. But you know what? I think the gist of what he's writing here is, if you're a foreigner, or if you're a German trying to learn English, for instance, then you learn the English alphabet and the sound that each letter is supposed to make, then you're wondering, why is that word not spelled that way, you know, as phonetically you would write it. Well, it's because of the rules of the English language, and that's just the way we've learned it over the years. So, but anyway.
Yeah, I wonder what it is about England that they developed their language the way they did.
Right.
So, unusual. Of course, they're smart. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I'm not anyway like a linguist. You know, I have no gift for. I don't think I have a good ear. I'm very visual, so I don't have a gift for languages, and I never went into it much.
Yeah.
So I can't answer those questions. How about you? What foreign language have you ever learned? Any?
Spanish,
yeah. Yeah, I took French in high school, and I had another one of those horrible teachers, and we just laughed and made fun of her, though, gave her a hard time the whole time. We were terrible. But our teachers were the problem. And I could memorize all the words. I could do well on the spelling test, French, you know, I could do well on that. But when it came to actually speaking and comprehending, when you put all these words together, I never got there. And, you know, 2 years in high school, at least for me, for the kind of class I was in, was not nearly enough to get anywhere with it. Although even today, I do a lot better in French, than some other languages, although I'm not so well anymore. But, you know, it's amazing how much you retain, but not an ability to actually speak it.
Yes, you know. That's a very good point. I learned years and years ago to read and write some Spanish, to speak, but, you know, it's a case of use it or lose it, and over the years you don't use it much, it'll start to slip away. But I am very confident that if I suddenly should wake up one morning and find myself in a country that spoke nothing but Spanish, I would be okay, because I could ask directions, I could tell them I was hurt, hungry, thirsty, sick, anything. You know, I can do that, and so I may not be able to carry on a conversation with a person, but I can listen, and if someone's talking to me in Spanish, or I can read some Spanish. So it's a matter of using it, as you know.
Yeah, you know, when I was in Mexico, I learned Spanish, and I thought I would become very fluent in Spanish, but it never happened. And of course, I started just spending all my time with English speaking people, and I didn't have to speak, but I knew a lot of Spanish to manage to do everything I needed to do and talk with people in kind of a rudimentary way. But as far as being really a conversationalist, never. And I was there a long time too, but see, I wasn't really amongst just Spanish speaking people. And then also, all these people there were learning English, and they could speak English with me. So I got really lazy about it. And but yeah, I'm familiar, I should say, Spanish words too. I know probably a lot more Spanish words than French words, and can kind of figure out when I'm reading something what's being said.
Sure.
But it would be, I don't know. They say that if you are multilingual, it's really good for your brain, because your brain has to think differently, or, you know, exercises your brain very well to change languages. I find that very difficult, too, if I'm speaking one language, just think about a word in another language and even say one word halfway right, you know, while I'm speaking the other language. But so that's where my brain doesn't work too well on that. It has no practice with it. But it's supposed to be one of the best things for keeping your brain flexible in your older age, is to know more than one language and speak more than one language. Well, Ray, I think we're going to quit early tonight, because
we don't have
time for this next section.
And I think that's good, because, excuse me, Carolyn, but I was just going to say this next section is fascinating, and it's a little over two pages long. And we wouldn't do it justice if we breezed through it and tried to just discuss it a little bit. We don't have the time to do that. And I think it's a great idea that we start there next week.
Yeah, it's a good place to start next week, where we have plenty of time to talk about it. We always feel in the beginning. So, all right. Well, therefore, our program for tonight, our Hitler's Table Talk, is episode 29, has come to an end. And so I'll let you say goodnight to the listeners, Ray, and I'll play the music when it's time.
All right, you bet, folks. I appreciate you joining us, and I hope you're getting enjoyment out of this, as Carolyn and I certainly are. And we invite you to be back with us next week, because, as usual, it's going to be a fascinating study. Thanks for joining us, folks, and we'll catch you next week.